I was reading one of the new books of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and he makes mention of the word in Pali, the word for meditation, or that's usually translated as meditation, is bhavana, and in Tibetan, I can't remember the Tibetan word, but what it translates as to familiarize, and I found that it sort of started me thinking, because also the word bhavana, in if we translate it more literally, means in English probably means more something more like developing or cultivating. You know, the feeling for our training, or particularly mental training, meditative training, is around this theme of developing, cultivating, familiarizing. Because sometimes the word meditation, we think of all sorts of things, but one of the things we think of is maybe what we shouldn't be doing, we shouldn't be thinking. Or we should be thinking something really special, or having something really special happening. But the kind of ordinariness of familiarizing, like familiarizing oneself with the breath, or familiarizing oneself with the way the body and the mind, how we experience it, or say developing a familiarity with the experience of what is our kind of conscious existence. Or maybe not even, doesn't necessarily even have to be conscious, in terms of what is the unconscious things. How do we develop a familiarity with even the sort of the subtle levels of our motivations and intentions and our habits and our conditioning. So then I think that is a much more comprehensive, maybe gives us a more comprehensive feel for what bhavana could be or should be. Because again, there's just that sense of meditation. It evokes certain ideas and biases in the mind. And when we sit down to meditate or for bhavana, what do we actually do? To take the meditation object and to really familiarize oneself with it, say like the breath, to bring it to mind, to apply the mind to the breath, to hold it, to keep it in mind. And then it said that the idiom that Ajahn Lee uses. It's like keeping the breath in mind. is a very apt way to put it. It's like keeping the breath in mind. And you know, it's very simple, but the tendency, of course, is to for the mind to wander, for the breath to cease to be very clear, or for us to lose interest in the breath, so that keeping the breath in mind. Making it very familiar, familiarizing oneself with the how to sustain attention, and then familiarizing oneself with the habits of mind of what happens to attention, what happens to the ability to sustain attention. So exploring that when we sit down to meditate. Because one of the things, what actually happens when we sit down to meditate? Because sometimes we do it just out of habit. Don't really keep the breath in mind. We sort of, we can lose our interest or cease to make it really that it has some life to it. Because we can be doing it just out of duty. Or with an expectation that something should be happening, and then you keep meditating over months, years, and you wonder, well, what am I getting? What I should be getting out of it? Of course, you don't know what you're supposed to be getting anyway. So you haven't really clearly formulated in the mind. Well, what am I actually doing? And so that there's this a hidden expectation that you should be getting something or doing something special. It should be special somehow. So that there's we don't actually question the underlying assumption that we make. So that the ability to keep the breath in mind, to keep the meditation object alive, and it gets undermined. So that it's easy to either think, well, maybe I'm not getting anywhere, or I'm not getting what I should be getting. So that as we practice, as we cultivate, as we develop, which is, let's say, these other nuances of the word bhavana, is cultivation and developing, a clarity of how we approach what we're doing, and that we're applying it to the meditation, but that developing of a clarity of application, it affects how we do everything, really, how we approach everything, or should be anyway, because the meditation shouldn't be separate from the rest of our existence, our life, because it's It's the same mind that sits and meditates as goes out and engages in activity and is speaking, is interacting, is taking on duties. And one approach, or one to remind ourselves of how to approach things, is how the Buddha taught his son, Rahula, and it seems very simple and very basic. The instruction that the Buddha, it was the first instruction that the Buddha, or the first recorded instruction that the Buddha gave to Rahula, and Rahula was the very first novice that was ordained. He was still very young, 7 years old at the time. So it's a very simple teaching, which he begins by speaking about truthfulness. But then the Buddha goes into the how to investigate the results, the intention that one brings to an action. Is this wholesome? Is it not wholesome? As one is considering doing something, as one is actually doing something, engaged in the action, and then after the action is completed, to reflect back and to see what the result was. So that, again, it sounds very simple. But it's curious how we miss out on these very simple things, and our life gets complicated and messy. So that the ability to take the time and the attention to reflect on, well, what is the intention? What is the volitional impulse that I bring to this, say, to this meditation, or to this breath, this moment? And again, this is something that we apply to the rest of our life. To make it very focused on sort of a small event, to bring it to the meditation, bring it to what's the volitional impulse, what's the intention behind that action of paying attention to the sensation of the breath coming in, the breath going out. And is it skillful? Is it unskillful? Is it clear? Is it not clear? And then as we're doing that, to be tracking that, what is the actual feeling? Is it wholesome? Is it skillful? Is it unwholesome? Is it painful? Is it feel spacious? Does it feel constricted? Is it satisfying? Is it unsatisfying? To be able to make that clear, and whether it's sort of the, say, one sort of breath or one moment, or the meditation period itself, and to go back and reflect back, and you know, not just sort of leap up and forget about it or let it things pass by, but say, what was that action? Was that skillful? That moment of attention, was that useful? Was it beneficial? Was it efficacious? Could I apply myself in some other way which would be more skillful? So that investigation is it's a really important part of a, say, forms the core of a spiritual practitioner, and I mean, it's actually also interesting how, in general, in terms of how people don't really learn from their experience, how we fall for the same old traps, or we're in situations that you wonder, why am I doing this? Well, how did I get here? What? There's a remember reading a story which was supposed to be true. It was in the papers. It's supposed to be true. It was purported to be true. I believe it. Yeah. That apparently there's a small town fire department goes out to a house, and that has smoke billowing out the bedroom window, fire people sort of break into the house, go up into the bedroom, find somebody lying on the bed. The bed is sort of burning, smoking, smoldering. Smoke is pouring out, filling the room and pouring out into the street. And they put the fire out and sort of pull the person off. And then when the kerfuffle settles down, they ask him, how did it start? You know. And he said, I don't know. It was, it was smoking when I laid down on it. I mean, it's painfully familiar to some of the, you know, like, you see some of the, you know, some of the arguments we get into, or some of the kind of desires that we get swept up into, and you think, and it's only after, I've been here before, I've done this already. why do I keep doing this? And it just has the same the same sort of pathos as lying down on a burning mattress. So that that necessity of having to familiarize. You know, what is the result of our actions? How do I approach an action? What's the feeling of an action while I'm engaged in it? And similar with the meditation. How to make this clear? How to really keep the breath in mind, to keep the mind on the breath. So it's not that, even though it's a very simple activity, it's actually not that easy, and it's not that it's not that easy to have that sustain quality. It really takes effort. So that the developing of and cultivation of an effort that is balanced, is able to keep an interest going without getting too obsessive or wound up or tight or anxious. And that's where the actual use of the thought processes is so essential in developing, because again that it's so often that we think of meditation as not thinking and then worrying about not thinking. I shouldn't be thinking, but that the thought processes of how we it isn't until the mind is really settled and really clear and really bright that those thinking processes sort of drop into the background, and it's a more natural kind of progression. But as we develop the practice, then we need to use those thinking processes. In Pali, it's vitakka vichara. Vitakka is like applied thought, and then vichara is like evaluation. So that taking of the applied thought and evaluation, vitakka vichara. And I remember Ajahn Chah talking about that use of vitakka vichara, and the lifting up of the meditation object, lifting up of attention to the breath. It's like the vitakka, applied thought. We're applying thought, applying the mind to the meditation. And then vichara is the evaluation of is it comfortable, is it not comfortable, is it clear, is it not clear, is it interesting, is it not interesting, how to make it interesting. That evaluation, looking at it from different angles so that one is able to take an interest and to sustain interest. Because without that evaluation and that, there's a kind of a malleability of the, and that's one of the qualities that the that the Buddha taught, the words that he uses for the mind that is peaceful and settled is malleable. It's not rigid. It's not inflexible. It's not one isn't sort of squished it into lifelessness. There's a malleability to it, so that there's this looking and interest from different angles of how what is the mind that's in balance? What's the mind that is sort of just right? What's the heart that is in accordance with the path? So that there's that applied thought of in kind of investigation or watching, and then the evaluation of the results or the application. So that as there is that applied thought or directed thought and its evaluation, then one becomes more clear and settled internally. And as the attention is sustained on the breath, on the object of meditation, then there's a natural focusing. Things come into perspective. It's like when you use binoculars. And you move them in and out a little bit, and you adjust it a little bit, and all the time you're doing that, it's all blurry. Especially for somebody who wears glasses, it's always difficult somehow to. Binoculars always, I find them really difficult to use. But there is a point where you just sort of get it just right, and then. Boom, it becomes clear. So that's like in meditation, where there needs that kind of adjusting and evaluating and watchfulness and attention. And then it becomes clear. And now, of course, if you're same with when you use binoculars, when you turn your attention to something else, then you've got to adjust it again. So similar in meditation, if you get it comes into focus, but you can't expect that to be a permanent state. It's natural that you're going to be looking at something else, or you're going to be looking at it in a different way, so that you have to be adjusting all the time, and it's quite a. And sometimes you think. I just want to sit here and be peaceful. I don't want to have to work. But that's actually not how the mind. It's just not how it functions. There's a certain work, but it's like because there's interest, then. It ceases to be sort of work. It's something that's really interesting. It's really fascinating, and that's the sometimes that like one of another word that's used for meditation say gammatthana, and kamma as in is a word that is action, activity. It's also sometimes used as work. It's sort of it's like the basis of our work. So that just by the words that are used, You're sort of evoking what we, you know, how we approach our practice, you know, to not sort of shrink back from the thinking and applying of the mind, or shrinking back from the reality that, that there is a certain activity, work that needs to be done. But when it's done skillfully, it's done in a way that is circumspect, and we're able to sustain attention, then the natural result is a quality of peace and clarity, and when the mind becomes very settled and peaceful, then it's also natural that we start to see things. You know, insight is a natural result. It's exactly why the Buddha encourages us to develop the meditation, to develop this practice, this training in tranquility and peacefulness, is because when the mind is settled, it just naturally, sort of insights naturally arise within. And it's those insights that allow us to really let go, to drop our sort of, you see the causal process more clearly, and you can drop the causes of what's behind the actual sort of suffering, discontent, dissatisfaction that we feel. The developing of the keeping the breath in mind, keeping the mind on the breath, taking that very simple activity. And you know, and then there's sometimes, of course, when the thinking mind does sort of run wild, and it becomes a distraction, becomes a disturbance. But it's just recognizing when you know, how to use the thought processes. But then, you know, in the same way like eating. I mean, it's like we have to eat. But then if we, you know, spend all the time eating, or eating junk food, or eating stuff that's food that's unhealthy, then that's the problem. The problem isn't the actual eating, because we have to eat. So similarly, with thinking, there's this thought process is what we have to learn how to use skillfully and how to rely on. But then, you know, if the thought processes start taking over and we get obsessed in unskillful tendencies of thought, or it just becomes obsessive and agitated, restless thinking, then we need to develop skillful means to undermine that tendency, so that, you know, like using a meditation word, mantra of some sort, counting, something that sort of overrides the thought process, and or just the, which is, yeah, and one has to be gauging the results of it as well. But sometimes it just helps to put that wedge of just like one phrase, one mantra, one word, Buddho, 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 to sort of create a wedge in the thinking process. Or just using rather than going to the thought processes, really trying to go to the feeling, the body, say the bodily sense of what does the body feel like? What's the breath feel like? So that there's a tuning in to this sort of the more nonverbal element of experience. And as we tune into that, then the sort of the thinking mind can drop away quite naturally. So that really taking the sensation of the breath, the rhythm of the breath, how the breath, how we feel it through the whole body. So going more to the experiential, non-verbal sensation of breathing. And tuning into it, then the sort of the thinking mind can drop away. And so there's different ways of working with it, and all we can do is experiment and see what works for ourselves, and also what actually works at different times. As we explore this, bhavana, the meditation, the cultivation, and that really familiarizing ourselves with the ways of the mind. It's that becoming really familiar with how attachment works, how our habits, our conditioning works, how our moods grab us, how we get hooked by them. It's that becoming very familiar, the familiarizing, that allows us to let go, or allows, and it doesn't necessarily mean it's not there, but it ceases to have the same hold over us. And so if we don't feed it, if we don't encourage it, if we don't, then it takes a back seat. And as it takes a back seat, it can start to sort of become more dormant, become more kind of to atrophy. And it's like with anything that we give attention to or feed or encourage. It grows on its own. It's like a plant. I mean, you water it, you fertilize it, you make sure it gets the proper light, and it grows like crazy. But if you can put it out of the light and not water it, and it'll start to sort of shrink and shrivel. So the same with sort of mental tendencies, and particularly to really sort of feed and nurture that which is skillful and that which isn't. You don't have to sort of destroy, annihilate, get in there and fight and struggle with it to the death sort of thing. It's just, don't give it a lot of attention. Don't feed it. Don't give it. Don't just not nurture it. And it shrinks, it falls away. That to recognize, well, what needs to be supported and encouraged, what needs to be just not given, because sometimes with our habits and tendencies, you know, even the ones that we see as unskillful, even that kind of worrying about them and fretting about them and having aversion towards them and thinking I shouldn't be like this, I mean that's a tension also, and gives it support. Our kind of attachments and obsessions. I mean, what are the different ways that we feed that? Yeah, that's where familiarizing ourselves with all the nuances of how we keep strengthening or keep supporting different tendencies that end up causing us suffering in the end. And how do we familiarize ourselves and become very skilled in those qualities which bring real clarity, real peace, contentment, satisfaction, happiness. Really taking an interest in that. How do I? Because you can, if you put attention onto that, they say that those other tendencies really taking an interest. Well, how do I make the mind bright and peaceful and happy? Rather than the obsessing, how can I get rid of this horrible tendency of mine? I mean, how can I get rid of this miserable attachment? What we pay attention to and how we pay attention, it will support these different tendencies. So obviously we have to recognize clearly, what are the negative tendencies, what are the unskillful ones, but if we pay attention to the positive in a skillful way, then the other things fall away, and we can, particularly, how do we make the mind peaceful? How do we allow the mind to become very settled and clear? Because that's sort of the one of the key parts of the Buddha's path. Because as we become more clear and say become more awake, cultivating that quality of Buddho, the one who was awakened, then that's kind of the key quality that gives us a foundation for say experiencing the fruits of the practice. I'll offer that for reflection this evening.